From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new book explores the very real advances in physics, neuroscience, and technology that may one day separate mind from matter.
Physics has given us the capability of reading thought inside the living brain, of moving objects with the mind, of recording memories, and even photographing dreams. All of this was considered science fiction 10, 15 years ago.
Writer June Melby recalls summers growing up around her family's miniature golf course in Waupaca. And our resident librarian poet makes the case for why physical libraries are still relevant.
And even if it's as simple as having access to an article database, the general public is never going to pay the thousands of dollars that it requires to have access to that kind of stuff.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Phenomena like telepathy, videotaping our dreams, implanting new memories into our brains, or performing telekinesis have long been the province of science fiction. But the rapid pace of international research into neuroscience and physics, along with advances in technology, have made or will make the impossible possible. Dr. Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist, the public face of science for TV shows like How the Universe Works, and the best-selling author of numerous popular books on science, including Parallel Worlds and Physics of the Impossible. His newest book is called The Future of the Mind, and in it, Kaku explores the secrets of the brain and mind from a physics perspective, the implications for future treatment for mental illness and paralysis to space travel are immense. Dr. Kaku was in Milwaukee in June to speak at an event hosted by the Milwaukee Center for Independence, an organization that works with people with disabilities. Prior to his arrival here, he joined me on the phone from his office in New York. Dr. Kaku, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, glad to be on.
In your book, The Future of the Mind, you say the two greatest mysteries in all of science are the universe and the mind. Now, you're a theoretical physicist, so the universe seems to be a natural place for you to be exploring. What does physics bring to the exploration of mind that, say, neuroscience doesn't?
Well, I'm a physicist, and my day job, I work on the Big Bang Theory to try to understand what set off the bang. That's one of the great mysteries of the universe. But the other mystery can also be probed by physics. Physics now allows us to look at the living brain, to actually see blood flow ricocheting across the brain. And we can now, in the last decade or so, expand our knowledge of the brain much larger than the sum total of everything we knew about the brain beforehand. And so, believe it or not, sitting on your shoulder is an object that only takes 20 watts of power and yet can outperform a city block worth of advanced computers. And now, using advanced physics sensors, we're beginning to probe the secrets of the brain for the first time.
So you say the brain. Talk to me a little bit about the difference between the brain and mind.
Well, the mind, we think, is in some sense software. Software that runs on wetware being the brain. And however, now we're beginning to realize that perhaps we can actually separate the two. President Barack Obama and the European Union last year stunned the world by saying that they're going to spend $1 billion to create a map, a computer map of every neuron of the brain. So we're going to have a connectome, a disk in the future that contains all our neural pathways and, in principle, contains all our memories, feelings, and emotions. So in the future, we're going to have two disks. One disk is the genome, which is the genetic makeup of the body. And the other one is the connectome, which contains the neural connections of the human mind. And so we're going to have two disks, the connectome and the genome.
So is mind not dependent upon the bodies that house it then? It sounds like that it isn't.
Well, historically, we thought that perhaps there's something called dualism, that is, the soul existed independent of the body. Then neuroscience tells us, no, the mind is more like software that runs on wetware. But now we're going back to the Middle Ages. In some sense, we might be able to separate the two, in which case, in some sense, even after you die, your connectome lives on forever. And of course, it all depends on how you define you. If you define you as this organic object, then of course that decays after you die. But in some sense, your memories, your emotions, your thoughts, even your, quote, soul, might be preserved even after you die once we have the connectome. And by the way, I should point out that there's a reason why politicians in Europe and the United States want to dump $1 billion into this project. This is not just a science project. They want to tease apart mental illness. That's why they're willing to spend $1 billion on this project, because, of course, the financial toll taken by schizophrenia, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's, and depression account for hundreds of billions of dollars in lost economic activity. And so mental illness, which goes all the way back to biblical times, is going to be one of the main targets for scientists as we try to figure out how the brain gets miswired to create mental illness.
So basically, the software is not working properly.
That's right. For example, when a schizophrenic hears voices, the left part of your brain generates voices. That's how you talk to yourself. We all do that. But the front part of your brain, the thinking brain, knows that the left part of the brain is generating voices. In schizophrenics, when you put them in a brain scan, you can actually see that their left side of the brain is active without their permission. So there is some kind of misconnection between the front part of the brain and the left part of the brain. And so the front part of the brain, the conscious brain, thinks that there's a mysterious voice coming from Mars or Jupiter or wherever, which is actually a voice coming from the left part of their brain. So a miswiring, in some sense, is responsible for madness. Madness we usually define as someone who's schizophrenic and hears voices. We cannot cure it, but we now know, in some sense, how it takes place when two parts of the brain don't communicate properly.
It's interesting. It sounds to me almost reductive in that we are only made up of this, but yet at the same time, we're bigger, or mind is bigger than the sum of the parts that create it, the physical sum of, you know, of the neurons. And I think maybe that's where the layperson kind of gets hung up on thinking about all of this stuff.
Yes, in some sense, the mind seems to emerge from the neurons of the brain. But now with computers, we can actually keep that the neural activity going independent of the brain. In other words, we can even enhance this activity. By putting a chip on the brain, for example, we can connect the brain to a computer and have the computer control a wheelchair, household appliances, people who are totally paralyzed because of a stroke or a car accident or a football accident, can now have their brain hooked up so that they can control a mechanical arm, an exoskeleton, mechanical legs, a wheelchair, household appliances. They can read email, write email, surf the web, play video games. And so in some sense, we're liberating them from the physical limitations of their body. And so the pure mind is allowed to interact with the computer and in some sense allow these individuals to lead a semi-normal life.
That leads me to a story that you talk about in the book, the Isaac Asimov science fiction story about how we in the very distant future learn to explore the universe by literally separating our minds from our bodies and sending our minds out to explore for us, or maybe they are us. And is that the future that you see in the future of the mind, helping people who are paraplegic or helping people who, for whatever reason, are trapped in the physical body and are trying, you know, to live a life?
Yeah, let's separate short-term and long-term. The short-term goal is to understand mental illness and also to liberate the mind from a paralyzed body so that you can control an exoskeleton, you can control arms, legs, turn on the TV set, surf the web, write email. That's the short-term goal. The longer-term goal, however, now that we go into many decades into the future, once we have the connectome, a disc with all your memories and sensations on it, why not send it on a laser beam into outer space? We send information on laser beams all the time. That's called the Internet. Why not shoot the laser to the moon? In 1 second, your consciousness, in some sense, can arrive on the moon without a booster rocket, without a spacesuit. 1 second. In about 20 minutes, you can send your connectome, that is your consciousness, to Mars. In 4 years, you can send your consciousness to the nearby stars. And so eventually, again, this is now centuries into the future, there could be a network of laser beams connecting planets together by which you can send your consciousness almost instantaneously across tremendous distances. And perhaps it already exists. Some physicists have speculated that perhaps aliens in outer space have already set this up, and we are too ignorant to realize that there's an intergalactic telephone system by which intelligent beings are zapping themselves across the galaxy. Now, of course, that's science fiction, but it cannot be ruled out by the laws of physics. The laws of physics make it possible that one day we may have an intergalactic telephone system.
This, of course, makes me think, you know, science fiction also tells us or warns us through many dystopian stories about the negative of that, you know, the fact that consciousness separated that way can be controlled by people with nefarious intent. And how do you see that in the future? How do we guard against that happening?
Well, there are many potential pitfalls that I mention in my book, The Future of the Mind. For example, we can now, for the first time in history, record a memory and actually insert a memory back into the brain. This was done in mice last year. It'll soon be done on primates and monkeys, and eventually in Alzheimer's patients, so that by pushing a button, Alzheimer's patients will have a brain pacemaker. A brain pacemaker by which they can insert memories into their damaged brain. Now, of course, the misuse of this technology is obvious. If a criminal were to take a memory of a crime that you never committed and insert that memory into your mind, you may think that you actually committed a crime when you actually didn't. And so I think in the future, we will perhaps be able to upload memories of vacations that we never took. However, we have to be labeled. They have to be labeled so you know that this vacation that you're experiencing never happened. Because, of course, criminals may want to insert their memories into your mind without your permission. So this will have to be regulated because, of course, in some sense, the set of your memories is, in some sense, very close to who you are.
Exactly. And I'm sitting here listening to you say that, and I'm thinking, well, you know, there could be governments that would insert things in, too. It's not just individuals. And I think that fear of a totalitarian regime, you know, controlling its populace that way, you know, has certainly been the subject of many stories. And I think we're probably rightfully afraid of it.
Well, let's separate the fact from the fiction. First of all, some people think that one day a spy will have a device that reads your mind from a distance. Well, that's not possible. The kinds of miraculous interfaces with the brains that I mentioned are done by placing probes directly on the brain or a sensor right on the scalp. When you go a certain distance away from the brain, brain waves start to damp so rapidly that it mixes with all the background noise that's out there, and you hear gibberish. So no one's going to be able to listen to your thoughts from a distance. However, the problem there is not reading your mind from a distance. The problem is accessing memories, memories that perhaps of things that never happened. And I think these will have to be regulated in the future if this technology takes off. For example, the Internet may be replaced by a brain net. A brain net by which we can send emotions and memories across the Internet. This is physically possible. In fact, we've already done some of this with animals already. However, it has to be, again, regulated so that you know that certain memories are fake and they're labeled clearly so that people's sense of reality and unreality is not altered.
Who do you see doing that regulating?
Well, of course, this is still decades in the future. We are talking about steps that were taken just last year at Wake Forest University and at MIT. However, we can foresee the time now when more complex memories can be inserted. For example, the memory of you firing a gun. That would be a memory that would be relatively easy, I think, to record and then reinsert into a brain. And if you insert that memory into an innocent person, then perhaps he thinks he pulled the trigger, killing someone when he actually didn't. So I think eventually the government may have to regulate these memories. But again, I caution that this is still many, many, many years into the future.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the idea of the quantum brain and how thinking about brain science in that way reveals new things about the mind.
Yeah, I'm a quantum physicist, and we're fascinated by the question of consciousness. Consciousness, of course, has been debated by philosophers for thousands of years. There are 20,000 papers written about consciousness, by the way. Never in science have so many devoted so much to produce so little. However, in my book, I give you a definition of consciousness and even a numerical scale by which we can rank consciousness. For example, an alligator, I think, would have a consciousness that's quite primitive, but an alligator understands its position in space. Monkeys have more complex brains because they understand emotions and relationships to other animals, not just their position in space. So what separates human consciousness from animal consciousness, I think, is the question of understanding tomorrow. Animals do not understand tomorrow. They understand instincts of today and now, but the concept of scheming and strategizing and daydreaming is totally alien to the animal mind. So our brain understands not just space, not just emotions and relationships to other people, but also time. We constantly daydream about the future, and that's what separates human consciousness from animal consciousness.
So as physicists and neuroscientists work together and separately in their own spheres about the future of the mind, what do you think the future of the mind is going to be?
Well, when we talk about telepathy, telekinesis, uploading memories, recording memories, we have to realize that we can do all of the above. Physics has given us the capability of reading thoughts inside the living brain, of moving objects with the mind, of recording memories, and even photographing dreams. All of this was considered science fiction 10, 15 years ago, but because of physics, we can do all of the above. But this is a powerful technology because, in some sense, who we are is a function of who we were. And therefore, if you can alter these memories, you can, in some sense, alter your very notion of your existence.
So your sense of self, our sense of who we are, is going to change in the future. It sounds like what you're saying.
That's right. In the short term, we're going to enhance our abilities. We're going to be able to telepathically communicate with other people, send thoughts on the internet, control avatars and surrogates and robots mentally. We're going to enhance the concept of who we are. But then the question is, if you can have your connectome, then not only can you enhance who you are, you can also immortalize who you are. In some sense, your memories, your sensations, your emotions will become immortal and will live on even after you die. And perhaps in the next century may even explore the universe via laser beams. And so we're liberating the mind from matter. We're separating the mind from matter and liberating it, enhancing it. And perhaps that's the next stage in our evolution.
Well, I'm ready to go explore the universe. I would. That is something that I would love to be able to do. So it probably won't happen in my lifetime, but maybe, you know, a few generations down the road.
Yes, but if your connectome is recorded, then the essence of who you are may very well live to see the day when all of this is possible, because your memories, your thoughts, your sensations, your sensibilities, all of that could be recorded. Is this possible? I think the answer is definitely yes.
Well, Dr. Michio Kaku, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. And now I want to go get my connectome recorded. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, my pleasure.
Dr. Michio Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City College and City University of New York, the co-founder of string field theory, which is a branch of string theory, and he's the best-selling author of numerous popular science books, including Einstein's Cosmos and Physics of the Future. His newest is The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. Dr. Kaku was in Milwaukee to give a talk earlier this summer, and he spoke with us then. We'll take a short break now, but don't go away. Coming up next, Iowa writer June Melby recalls summers growing up around her family's miniature golf course in Waupaca. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. There are still a few precious weeks of summer ahead for us, still time to squeeze in a trip or two up north, or a few afternoons at the beach, or maybe a round or two of miniature golf. Writer June Melby experienced more than a few summer afternoons of mini golf when she was a girl, but it was not the experience you or I probably had. Melby grew up in Decorah, Iowa, but one day, when she was still in elementary school, her parents announced that they had purchased the Tom Thumb Mini Golf in Wapaka, Wisconsin. And from then on, the family would relocate there each summer to run the classic old golf course and its many obstacles. Years later, Melby had left the Midwest to pursue a life performing in Hollywood when she got the heart-wrenching word that her parents were selling the course. When it was all said and done, Melby looked back on those days in a memoir called My Family and Other Hazards. Speaking with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke, Melby explained when she realized that losing the golf course would be like losing a part of herself.
I think the second I got the message. I mean, that's the funny thing. I heard, you know, I saw that I had missed a phone call. I saw the blinking red light, and I knew it had sold. And I instantly knew. It was devastating. You know, it was, you know, which surprised the heck out of me. I mean, it was really like hearing your grandfather was dead or something. And I was like, well, wait a second. It's a miniature golf course, and we knew it was for sale. So, you know, my response kind of, completely bewildered me.
Well, and so what emotions were you still trying to sort out when you sat down to write the memoir?
You know, I always apparently thought that I would become a huge success in Hollywood, and then I would sweep back to the Midwest with my great earnings and rescue my parents. Not that they needed rescuing, but then, you know, be able to buy it from them so they could retire, and I would be the superhero, la, la, la.
Think of the great story that would be in People magazine.
I don't know. So I had these grandiose ideas. Apparently, they weren't quite conscious, you know, but they were definitely triggered when I found out, you know, it's it. We found people to buy it. It took four people to come up with the money. You know, too late. Too late.
Well, let's turn the clock even further back. You were 10 years old and living in Northeast Iowa when your parents announced that from here on out you'd be living in Wapaka in the summers to run Tom Thumb Mini Golf. What were they thinking in making that decision?
Well, I don't think they were thinking. Oh, that just sounds really bad. But it just fell into their laps. That's how they put it. They were definitely looking for some kind of summer thing to do. He's a, you know, school teachers need to make some money, or at least try to make some money. So that's the ironic thing, because they actually never charge enough money at the mini golf to make any profit. So that's ironic. But it really just sort of like, well, it's for sale. Wouldn't that be interesting? Maybe we should consider that.
And then there you were.
Basically.
Well, and so paint a picture of the place, if you would. There are miniature golf courses in the Milwaukee area, but they are often today part of, we'll put it in quotation marks, amusement complexes. Right. And that is not what this miniature golf course was.
No. It's very different. Well, it's in Wapaka, and it's on the Channel Lakes. It's actually on a lake. You know, it wasn't built on a strip with other businesses. There's no bumper cars driving ranges. Right. None of that.
There's not a batting cage.
No. So it's actually it's a lakefront cottage that someone decided to build a mini golf course in the yard. So everything else on the street, on the road, is a cottage.
And this is in the days before zoning.
Exactly. There was no zoning. So the school teacher in 1959 named Greg Charlesworth just built a mini golf course from whatever he had on hand. So the property was, you know, on a lake. People could come to the mini golf from the water on their big pontoon boat, their canoe, or drive up or bike up by land. So we were surrounded. Basically, they came off from all directions.
For your family, this was obviously not a lifelong dream realized in those terms. But your dad, who, as you say, was a high school teacher, sounds like he took his role seriously once it started in kind of maintaining a challenging course.
Oh, good gracious. Yeah. His ideal business model was to make a course that was entertaining and challenging so people would come back again and again and again and again. And he also was sort of a frustrated inventor. So instead of doing things like, you know, I don't know, maybe a normal business practice would be like thinking up other ways of bringing in money, like putting in a game room or something. He would tinker in the garage to make very complicated and elaborate moving hazards. So we had six moving hazards on the course, where I think most have maybe one or two. I'm not sure.
Well, and you write about one of them, which sounds like it took its inspiration from drag racing. But I think you write that I don't know that anybody knew what that inspiration was when they played the course.
He claimed this. Do you want me to read the thing?
Sure.
I don't know if I can paraphrase it. And it's hard to explain it.
Why don't you give us a little flavor?
Okay. One reason there were so many hazards at number four is that it was here that my father, a teacher of physics and chemistry, began carrying out what you could call his experiments. He created a device we called the colored light thing. If the Nobel Committee, in addition to awards for literature and medicine, voted to acknowledge the most complicated gizmo on the planet designed to hinder the path of miniature golf balls, the colored light thing would win the prize, and my father would dress in a tuxedo and step up to the podium, and everyone in Sweden would lean forward in their seats to learn from the expert how it worked. And my father would look into the microphone and say, "Well, and then chuckle a bit. Because even though he was the one who built it, the one to design it, the one who thought it was a good idea in the first place, he finds it a very difficult contraption to explain. I do too. From the outside, the colored light thing looked like a white plywood box about the size of an ottoman. On the top, there protruded a 2-foot tower. It had 4 red lights on one side, 4 green lights on the other. The lights would click from red to green. When all 4 lights were green, a flap, like a doggy door, would lift up from underneath, and people would madly putt their ball. And then a click. The lights all went back to red, and the door would close again. According to Dad, the colored light thing was supposed to resemble the starting lights at a drag strip race. It's called a Christmas tree, he said. We never knew what he was talking about, and no one who came to play did either. In 30 years, we never heard anyone refer to number 4 as a drag racing tree. People called it that white box, or that thing with the lights. Others simply called it that one where my ball is stuck underneath. And now, without further ado, my father will try to explain his grand invention, the colored light thing. The first version I made used 2 solenoids, and when that door opened, it went boom! He claps his hands to demonstrate the explosion. The voltage was too high, noisy, and not really safe around people. Boom! He claps again and laughs, so I had to change the whole shebang. He tells me that the next version used roller skate wheels. Why roller skate wheels, I ask. I don't know. Maybe I just had them around. Eventually, he replaced the colored light thing, not because the mechanism broke down, but because he almost had a nervous breakdown whenever tourists shoved their putters underneath to push out their balls. In the end, it was his love for the invention and his need to protect it from people that finished the hazard's life.
June Melby reading from My Family and Other Hazards, all about hole number 4. How difficult was it to take each of the 18 holes on this course and find something metaphorical in it?
It wasn't hard at all. I did structure the book around the 18 hazards. There are 18 chapters, and that was easy and really fun. I know I did that because I thought it'd be a fun way to write it. You know, boy, you love-hate relationship with each of these hazards, you know, because they required so much upkeep. You know, anything made in 1959 and has been out in the weather requires a lot of paint. And
right, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of repurposed stuff that was
repurposed.
on this course.
That's a new word for an old-fashioned way. You know, the man who'd built it was from the Depression era, just like my dad, and the turrets of the castle we found out one day when we lifted them up, they were like empty soup or fruit cans. And with the flagpole was perhaps a repurposed television antenna back from, for those who remember what a television antenna looked like.
There's an old rocking horse on the course.
There's a rocking horse, yeah, a horse that leaps over the hurdle. So, you know, that was really fun for me, finding a theme for each one. You know, for example, the windmill. Okay, we have a windmill because, you know, why is it everyone who comes to mini golf has to have a windmill? And so we have a windmill. So that's hole number 9. So chapter 9 is about them, the customers, and, you know, what you do for them because that's what they need.
When you were a kid, it would be easy to resent the potential summer vacations lost by spending the summer working to run a mini golf course. And you're right about missing that and spending, you know, your big getaway on your birthday was going with your sister to use the running showers at the campground nearby. But today,
we loved sneaking into the camp crowd. It was the sneaking in and doing something we considered illegal that was so charming for us.
Today, though, how do you evaluate what summers could have been versus what they actually were?
Oh, good gracious. How long a time do we have to talk? I mean,
and it seems too easy to say that, you know, today I realized that these were the best days of my life.
You know, it's so complicated because, you know, yes, we didn't have the chance to pile in the station wagon and drive across the country to go to the national parks or wherever kind of ideal people think of for a summer vacation. But on the other hand, you know, we had this place that needed all of us to work at it to make it what it was. And it really brought us together in ways I didn't realize. And we're all such different people. That's why it was kind of fun to write the book. We're all very different from each other. And the other thing is that having a place that's colorful and fun in your backyard is not a terrible thing, you know? People would show up and laugh and laugh. So all hours of the day, you've got people laughing with each other. That's not a terrible thing at all. You know, yes, it's weird to look out your bedroom window and see a clown. Okay, sure. But
this is the clown on hole 18. This is not a clown
hole.
Playing miniature golf.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, that would be a little too weird.
Oh, it sounds like there were plenty of weird people that did show up.
Oh, sure. You know, and, you know, and people on vacation drop their guard a little bit, I think we all know.
You describe being mortified by the biker gang that showed up.
Oh, the motorcycle gang. Oh, the first time we had a motorcycle gang show, we were panicked because, you know, they dress to intimidate. And, you know, here's this course. It's little tiny, delicate, moving things that anyone who wanted to could really wreak havoc. But that was just so charming. They loved it. They were like little, not teddy bears out there? I don't know how you put it. We were learned, like, you not to judge people. And, you know, it really was a great experience. You know, you can learn so much by just watching people.
Well, and it must have been pretty powerful to realize, maybe even still today, that generations of summer vacation pictures of people that you know, maybe knew a little and many you didn't know at all are of your backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, that you had this hand in, you know, the success or failure of somebody's getaway.
I know. I mean, I'm sort of possessively would love to see these pictures because, you know, yeah, we did put so much of our time towards other people's family get-togethers and vacations, and we'd love to see that results, but they've told us, you know.
I'm sure there are people listening to this interview who will have remembered time spent on the Tom Thumb golf course.
I did a reading at Boswell Books in Milwaukee, and a good portion of the people there came up and said, oh, yes, we've been playing for many years, or we used to rent a cabin across the lake from Tom Thumb and came to play every summer. So it's awesome because we shared with these people. Yeah, we didn't know their names, but we knew their faces because they kept coming back.
Nostalgia and sentimentality sometimes get a bad rap, but yeah. I gather you have come to embrace this in yourself.
You know, I don't understand why they get a bad rap, really. I mean, I think there's such a hype these days to keep up with things because of technology, and there's this pressure to buy the latest things or you get left behind. But I think most of us really have this great, I don't know, what is nostalgia? You're realizing there's something very charming about things and people and places in our childhood, especially.
Well, and I got to talking with one of our essayists here the other day about our respective kids and how much they enjoy hearing stories about their parents' childhoods. And it struck both of us that, you know, of course we don't consider this stuff history as it's taking place. And now we get older and it seems like, you know, suddenly we appreciate this time before and we get likewise this kind of nostalgia for the present, this realization that you know, we're ephemeral.
Yeah, it's happening now. It's also happening now.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that funny?
This interview will be over soon.
Don't tell me it's true. You know, I've been asked, so what's it like writing a book after doing stand-up comedy? Is there any kind of overlap? What did you learn from that? And they expect me to talk about punchlines or word choice. And that's true. You do learn how to keep things tight. But the other thing I think I learned is when you do stand-up comedy, what you're doing is you're saying, I think there's something we all share, me and this, everybody in this audience, that we all kind of agree on, and you may not be conscious of it. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I'm going to be the one who just will take that leap. And I'm just going to assume you're going to follow me. And so maybe that's what the overlap is. So I'm saying here in this book, I think nostalgia is way more common than we like to admit. And I'm just going to go ahead and say, you know what? There were some really awesome times at Tom Thumb. And yes, I miss it. And everybody else probably has their own family traditions that they do every summer. And maybe they miss them too or still do them.
Well, and, you know, nostalgia and sentimentality sometimes, you know, gets the bad rap. But then you say authenticity and people think, oh, I want something authentic. And really, they're talking about the same thing. When you go to a place like Tom Thumb and you're actually having this fun and in the moment and it is, you know, in a way, unself-conscious, both the golf course and the fun that you're having, it's a much different thing than living for Instagram.
Yeah. You know, I think what this brings to mind, too, is the last days that my parents had Tom Thumb, there was still the real estate for sale sign out front. And, yes, someone had offered to purchase it, and they said they were going to run it, but there was this uncertainty. And so then, as my mom said, people realized it may not be here next year. It may not go on. And they came to the ticket booth semi-panicked, asking, you know, will this still be here? Are you going to be here? Is it closed forever? And they took it for granted until that moment.
Well, June Melby, it's a delightful book. I'm glad we could share your history and your past, and best of luck in the future.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
June Melby's memoir about summers growing up around her parents' Wapaka miniature golf course is called My Family and Other Hazards. Melby is back, living in her hometown of Decorah, Iowa, and she spoke with Mitch Tyke on a recent book tour, which included stops at Books & Company and Boswell Book Company. You can find out more about June Melby, plus see a link to the real estate listing for Tom Thumb, just in case you'd like to become the latest steward of that Wapaka mini golf tradition, on WUWM.com/lake effect. We'll take one last break and then meet a librarian and poet who writes poetry about libraries. We'll hear all about it in just a moment when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Libraries hold millions of stories. They can be found in books, magazines, video, and online. But librarians know and often tap into another source of unique, lesser-known stories from their patrons. Erin Larandos, librarian and returning poet, has started a new blog project that she hopes everyone will use. Poetry in the Stacks invites all library visitors and the librarians themselves to tap into their creative energies and express their library experiences through poetry. Larandos joins Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson to share some poetry and to explain exactly what meeting visitors face-to-face gives the librarian that digital communications don't.
Well, we still actually have a lot of interaction with our patrons face-to-face, and that's different in different types of libraries, of course. When I worked in the academic library, most of my reference interactions and that sort of thing were definitely online. We had chat reference and over the phone and email and all that sort of thing. And we do that in the public libraries, too. But, of course, most of our patrons just come to us for the questions that they have. And I like that because you can really gauge how well a person is understanding what you're saying, and you're able to kind of change trajectory as you're talking, and you're able to customize that experience for that patron a lot better in a face-to-face interaction, I believe, for sure.
Do you believe or do you think that that's going to change as the roles of the libraries might be changing? Or do you think that that human interaction is still going to be there with the library institution?
I think that it will always be there because there's always going to be a group of people who prefer that. We have definitely grown as a profession and as an institution to accommodate different types of interaction and different types of information that we're giving and receiving, of course, from our patrons. But I think there's always going to be a place for the physical library for sure. There's always going to be a group of people who need to be shown how to use whatever new technology it is or you know, whatever resource it is. And I think the most important thing that people forget about libraries is we have access to a lot of stuff that you don't just using the internet at home. And even if it's as simple as having access to an article database or something like that, the general public is never going to pay the thousands of dollars that it requires to have access to that kind of stuff. And so we can act as that intermediary and show people how to use it, how to recognize good information versus bad information, and, you know, allow them to have access to those things that they can't afford at home. If it's as simple as an internet connection or something way up to, you know, some very specific informational resource that we have that they wouldn't have at home.
And so these poems, which is why I'm asking you all these questions, are about your interactions with patrons and the patrons' interactions with you guys.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Please share some of these poems.
Okay, so the first one I'd like to share, it actually has a title.
What?
I know, you guys are amazed. So I'll just give you a little bit of background. This poem is called Enigma, and that is in reference to the Enigma machine that was captured during World War II. If you've seen the movie U-571, you'll be familiar with the story. The Americans were going after this Enigma machine that helped break the code for the ciphers that the Germans were sending. And it was on this boat. It was actually on the U-505, but apparently U-571 makes a better title for a movie, so they changed it. and when the Americans went to capture this piece of technology that the Germans were using, well, you'll know from the movie, there was a bit of a snafu, and the American boat was sunk. And so they were forced to board and try to operate the German U-boat. And of course, being Americans, most of them didn't read German and weren't, you know, prepared for that to happen. And so they had to deal with those consequences, of course. But ultimately, we were successful in capturing the Enigma machine on May 9th, 1941, and that was an instrumental part of our ability then to decipher the German transmissions and know more about what their plans were and able to attack them more accurately and things like that. So the gentleman that came into the library actually was on that boat. He was on the U.S. boat that went after the U-505, and he started out by asking me for information about his commanding officer. And I'm just looking, you know, and I'm finding some articles about him. And I'm like, oh, yeah, he was instrumental in capturing the Enigma machine. And he's like, yes, I know, I was there. And I was just like, what? You know, I mean, of all of the random people to come into the library, somebody with all of this experience and all of this history attached to them, that's the coolest thing about working in the library is you never know who you're going to be able to talk to. And here I had this opportunity then to talk to this gentleman who is, of course, getting up there in age now, who had this amazing experience in his life and was a part of a mission that was so instrumental to us eventually winning the war against Germany. And I was just so struck by that interaction that I decided to write a poem about it. And so here it is, Enigma. Child, I was there, he said, with quiet, seeming abandoned as he waited for me to find for him a memory, proof of what he knows as truth, of what history has forgotten, written, spoken in code, broken by our boys, now old men, waiting for us to remember.
And that's the beauty about libraries is that you can go there and you can discover information about yourself, but also the people that you know about and the things that you've taken part in. And no matter what age, you can always still learn.
Exactly, exactly. And luckily, I was able to find some validating articles for him relating to what he had remembered that, you know, now since the world knows that history through this movie, which apparently wasn't super accurate, go figure, he was able to, you know, reconstruct that history in his own mind.
Definitely. What's the next poem for us?
This one is called Baha'i. And if you're unfamiliar with that term, it's a religious group, and they have a pretty big representation in the Midwest. I know there's a beautiful Baha'i temple in Evanston, Illinois, which is not too far away from you guys there in Milwaukee, which I would highly recommend, even if you're not of a religious persuasion. These beautiful buildings are just something you have to see. So definitely take a look at that if you're down the Illinois way. But this gentleman is a person who comes to our digital help desk almost every single day that it's open. He needs a lot of digital help, apparently. But he's become one of our regulars, and he has a very interesting history as well that I have been able to learn more about as I've been helping him through this desk. And this desk is a different type of desk in our library. We provide one-on-one digital assistance. So anybody coming in with any sort of device, you know, their laptop or a Nook or a Kindle or an iPod, something like that, we can help them learn how to use that device with our library's resources. So how to download ebooks or how to download music. We don't have CDs anymore in our library. We have a service online that allows patrons to download songs instead. And so these are things that people need to be taught how to use, of course, or at least how to use with their specific device. And so we have this desk open. Right now it's just 6 hours a week, but we plan on expanding that, where folks can just come in. We're open for 2 hours at a time, and they just come in and get that one-on-one help. And I haven't seen that a lot in other libraries where I've worked, so it's really cool to be a part of. But anyway, this gentleman, I have learned, he is originally from Iraq. His family has been persecuted because of their religious beliefs. And the Baha'i are in opposition to the Muslims and other groups that are more prevalent and more powerful in those areas. And he has, because of that, he moved to the U.S. and he lost a lot before he came here. And so he has been able to tell me a lot of those stories. And so this poem, Baha'i, is a reflection on him. He's telling me his story, and these are some sentences pulled directly from conversations that I've had with him. So you'll kind of get an idea of how he talks and how he thinks about the world from this poem.
Interesting. Okay.
All right, here we go. I tell you this now, he says, because you are my daughter. What makes the flower white like your skin while mine is dark? What makes leaves green? And that man over there, he won't talk to me. Because I think it is because I am not like him. We pray to different gods when we really just need to love.
Wow. Those conversations must be fascinating.
He is a very interesting gentleman, yes. He is also very feisty, which makes it kind of fun to talk to him. But he gets very philosophical, as you can tell, as well.
Definitely. And then the last poem.
The last poem I would like to share is an interaction that I had with a young patron in our youth services department.
Hmm.
And if anyone out there works with kids, you'll know they're an interesting breed. And one thing that I love about my library is that all of us librarians and all the other folks who work in the library at the desk rotate between all of the desks. And so we all work in the reference department, so we all get to talk to the gentleman and his Enigma machine. You know, we all work at the circulation desk, so we all deal with the, well, I never checked out those books that you were charging me for and all of that sort of thing. Uh-huh. And we all get to work on the youth desk, and so we all get to influence many different types of patrons. And you can tell the interactions at those different desks vary as greatly as the type of patron you're serving. Please don't run. But I forgot something, and it's really important. What's that? My game, or my drink, or my bag, or my book. I don't remember. Well, we can still be safe. Yes, I know. I just needed to hurry.
That sounds pretty accurate.
Yep. You know all about this.
Oh, I do. With my library experience, yes, I do. Exactly. And teaching experience, but yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Speaking of interactions with community members and the patrons, you are actually starting a brand new project. So
I
could you tell us a little bit about the Poetry in the Stacks?
Yes. So a Poetry in the Stacks is a new website or blog that I just started not too long ago to kind of compile poetry written in, about, or in relation to libraries. And I think that, you know, this is going to be a very interesting project, as you kind of saw from the different interactions that I have just in one library. And those three things could have happened in one day. The wide range of things that we experience is so great. I really am anxious to see what other folks might come up with as far as poetry relating to their libraries and their patrons that they serve. And so I would love for people to submit to this project. I have a specific email set up for submissions.
That can be found on the website.
And it can be found on the website, exactly. It's poetryinthestacks@gmail.com. And if you have any poetry that you've written about libraries or about interactions or just written in a library even, because I feel that the library then becomes an active player in the art you're creating because of the ideas that, you know, are free-flowing there. I would love for people to submit to this, and I hope to grow it into something that's as wide and varied as the experiences that we all have in libraries. And these can be written by librarians. These can be written by folks doing research at, you know, at the library on campus. These can be written by patrons, anything. So I would love to hear what you guys have to say.
And it's fascinating as well, because being a patron or a librarian, you are having two different kinds of interactions with the library itself.
Exactly.
And I think that would be really interesting to catch, and the different backgrounds and the different age groups. I think that would really be interesting to read. And what happens with these poems once they are submitted?
Well, obviously, because it's my project, I get to decide what goes on the website. But, you know, as long as we're not being too mean to the patrons, I'll pretty much post anything that you guys send me. But on the blog, which is poetryinthestacks.wordpress.com, I have started to compile a few of the ones that I just read today, as well as some written by more established poets. And I would love to post whatever you guys send to me on this website, and then we can share it with the world.
Excellent. All right. Well, Erin Lorandos, thank you so much for sharing your poetry and your new project with us, and we hope to participate.
Of course. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Erin Lorandos, librarian and poet, created Poetry in the Stacks, a blog that invites librarians and patrons to write poetry about their experiences in the library. More information can be found at wuwm.com/lakeeffect, and Lorandos spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.